When On Film last checked in with emerging filmmaker James Adebito, he was in the midst of a Seed and Spark campaign raising post-production funds to bring his latest film, I See a Darkness, to audiences and the film festival circuit. I See a Darkness was shot entirely in El Paso with a cast and crew of area filmmakers and creatives. Much like its title, it follows a photographer's descent into an existential crisis that threatens to upend, or break open and free, his life and career. I'm Kyle Alvarado, sitting in for Charles Horak, and on today's episode, we're checking in with James as he readies to release his film and screen it in festivals across the world. Good morning, James. How are you?
Morning, Kyle. I'm doing well. How are you?
As well as can be expected.
Right. Yeah, these are trying times.
Oh, boy. So when we last checked in with you, the Seed and Spark campaign for I See a Darkness, which, full disclosure, I proudly contributed to.
Thank you.
Always happy to. Had ended, and it surpassed its goal, funding the film through post-production, and it helped create a launchpad for film festival entry. And I'd like to start there. What was the post-production-like period for you?
The post-production period was really illuminating for our film. Most films, you know, have a very long post-production process, and for independent films that can be, you know, exponentially true. Just as you're trying to, like, we had this Seed and Spark campaign, we were trying to capture the funds to hire the post-production crew we wanted. And, you know, like you said, luckily we did achieve that goal, which was fantastic because it enabled us to hire a really amazing post-production team. All local El Paso professionals. And it really did add to the film and changed, you know, what the film was and how it was edited, things like that.
Had there been anything, you know, when a film is written and shot, you know, it's one thing when you're sort of there on the day, as you were, you know, trying different cuts and playing with color correction, were there new sort of elements that you, unexpected elements that you had sort of discovered, you know, in relation to themes of the film?
Absolutely. The editing was extremely different than the film that was written. Once we got into post-production, I kind of had this just creative idea, and I wanted to throw out the traditional methods of narrative editing with the film. Mm-hmm. Because the structure of the film, I wanted it to be closer to like a mood piece and a thematic piece instead of the traditional straightforward narrative. Mm-hmm. So there is that in there, but it really, you know, through the editing process, it required a lot of discovery and going back and forth with the amazing editor I was able to hire, Zach Passero. Mm-hmm. It was really great to work with him because he's such a professional and, you know, he's like this wisdom, this guru of editing. So it was, you know, it was great to bounce ideas off of him. And we really were able to create just this kind of abstract version of what this character was going through.
And, you know, speaking of sort of abstractions, one of the very sort of strong elements about the film, and I think it added to it quite a lot, was the musical score by Jim Ward. I think the best way to describe, for me, it's almost less of a score and more of a soundscape in how it sort of envelops the world and these characters. What was that like working with Jim Ward?
Well, it's really funny that you said it's more of like a soundscape and less like a score. Because when we were doing the editing of the film, we kind of edited in concurrent with the creation of the score. We had temp music, and our temp music, I'm a big fan of Shigeru Umbayashi. So I was using that for temp music. And so we had this like symphonic, but like dreamlike quality. You know, he uses full symphonies. So as Jim and I started working together, we wanted that same dreamy feeling, but like in a very simple manner. Mainly it's with one instrument and a guitar. Mm-hmm. And we were really interested in, and we had a lot of conversations back and forth. Like he would give me samples of stuff and you know, he was watching the film and kind of getting the mood and the feel of the character because we had a lot of conversations about the loose narrative structure, how the music was important and needed to be a reflection of what the character was kind of feeling. And it really is part of the fabric of the film because, you know, it pushes the character along as he drifts from kind of one existential mistake to another and another and another. And, you know, the music ties that together because it isn't a typical narrative structure. It was really important. And I think Jim just knocked it out of the park. It's amazing.
So you mentioned that, you know, the narrative structure is a different sort of take compared to traditional films. Why take that approach to the movie?
Well, really, what I was interested in capturing was more of a feeling of what the character was going through, as opposed to, you know, this happens and that happens and that happens and that happens. I'm a big fan of films that kind of take you on a journey that way. And so I was trying to do that. and these were the ways we tried to achieve it.
And, you know, obviously without spoiling the film for people who haven't seen it, I was lucky enough to see it earlier this week. It generally follows, you know, a photographer, Alex, played by Frank Leal, who is essentially just sort of, who's descending into sort of an existential crisis, particularly in relation to his artistic expression, perhaps even a severe depression. Do you feel that creative people often struggle with these sort of mental health issues when they aren't creatively satisfied?
Yeah, definitely. That was one of the key things I was interested in when I first started this project, is there's sort of this popular culture external idea of what a creative person should be these days. Every day, you know, throughout time, it's always been that way. And this character kind of wants that. He feels that he should be creating things like that. And when he is, there's this emptiness to him. So inadvertently, it affects his relationship. It affects his relationship with work, and it affects his relationship with his father. And one of the things with that is kind of deals with the handing down of masculinity, mm-hmm. you know, through generations. Like, father's car is given to him, and it's this muscle car of, like, you know, representation of masculinity that he's sort of forced to drive. And, you know, he's forced to take pictures of these models, and that's what he's supposed to enjoy, but does he really want to? And so, yeah, I mean, these sort of things can unbeknownstly cause, like, depression. You know, long story short, that all of those things bounce off of each other. You know, the issues with generational toxic masculinity, forced artistic expression from popular culture, and they really have an effect on his relationship and his mental health. And yeah, definitely some sort of deep depression.
And, you know, you bring up the car, and the 68 Camaro features prominently in the film.
Absolutely.
One of the opening shots, you know, it almost feels like one of those sort of vintage Americana images, you know, the man in the t-shirt, the grungy t-shirt, you know, laying on the car while the sun sets out in the desert. But normally when you think of those images, there's a lot of sort of masculinity injected into it. And with these shots, there's a somberness associated with them. And I think that speaks to sort of the larger ways in which you use cinematography, particularly the El Paso settings, you know, the downtown areas, the open desert spaces, to create, you know, as our friend Charles often speaks of, these cinema spaces, which show the connection between a physical space a character moves through in relation to their overall psyche. How did those open spaces of the desert and the downtown areas create, or how do these characters fit into these worlds?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, first off, I want to give a shout out to the amazing cinematographer, Renato Limon. Mm-hmm. We had a lot of conversations about this early on and how we can do just that. For the different characters, if you notice in the film, there's different neighborhoods and different structures that we shoot in. So for the main character, Alex, we shot in an older historic neighborhood, Sunset Heights. You know, we wanted a less suburban feel. And a lot of those houses are older. They're kind of, not all of them, but some of them, you know, they're decaying a little bit. They're not taken care of that much. It's very charming, but there's also a representation of the visual decay of Alex, you know, where he lives in this way. For another character, Anna, we wanted to be in Segundo Barrio because, you know, it's such a prominent neighborhood in El Paso that doesn't really get a lot of screen time. You know, and within all of these neighborhoods and areas, we wanted it to be isolatory. So there's not a lot of other people around. It expresses the loneliness of all the characters because they're all going through some sort of existential crisis in a way, if not brought on by the main character, Alex, then their own crisis. So that was important. And one of the big things was the desert that I wanted to shoot in because it is such a big part of the border region, and the native culture is a huge part of El Paso and the surrounding areas. And, you know, I wanted to bring that into the film with the scenes of the desert, like the coyote, you know, to kind of represent native culture, and gives this ethereal effect on what's happening with Alex, even though you mentioned, just like you mentioned with his, you know, there's these iconic shots, but at the same time, there's a sort of like mysticism to what's going on with him.
Yeah. You know, as we're talking about this film, it certainly sounds like we're this dour, heavy film, and it is. But one of the, one of the elements that I really loved about it is that it was quite funny in some parts. There was a bit where Alex is at work and he's on a group chat, and it just sort of bounces between the sounds of the messages coming in and just the reactions on the faces, ultimately leading to an awkward conclusion in that scene. A lot of these satirical elements are sort of related to his work, especially when he's shooting these models in these, you know, saccharinely sexy sort of ways. What was sort of that idea, sort of looking at the sort of the perversion of the creative process for marketing, advertising, and profit?
Well, yeah, that was definitely important to show Alex in the workplace, and how he reacts to everybody else was definitely important, because he's a square peg and in a round hole in that environment. He works for a marketing firm. He's sort of forced to deal with clients, which, you know, if anyone's worked in that sort of field, and there's this kind of artistic representation that's not there, you know, like you're working for somebody who's trying to sell something. So there's a certain way they want it to be viewed, and you have to do that. So that kind of steeps down into his interactions with everybody else, who's kind of comfortable with that. They're like, they're okay. They're like, well, this is my job. This is what I'm doing. That's fine. And he's not, you know, so they butt up against each other. And that's, I think, where the kind of satirical comedy comes in, because it really is funny at the end of the day when you think about it.
Yeah.
Because, you know, what we, you know, the whole marketing world and the art world. And
it's an uneasy balance sometimes.
Yeah, exactly. And if you're too serious about it one way or the other, then you can kind of drown yourself in that world.
Oh, yeah. So now that the film is complete, it's beginning to circulate in film festivals. If I remember correctly, it's actually been accepted in a few of them. Can you talk a little bit about that process? And did the pandemic affect any of that output?
Yeah, for sure. Yeah, it was a big it was a big letdown, actually. We finished post-production March 9th of this year. We did our final sound design, sound designer Andrew Smedic. Great work on the sound design. He's an amazing designer, and we had spent a lot of time on it. We finally finished. We're like, cool, it's done. That was the last element of it. And, you know, we're in lockdown a week later. And it's like, oh, okay. So, I mean, the idea of, especially for these micro-budget films, and this isn't even an independent film. This is micro-budget. This is like super low budget. You're kind of living and dying by festivals and by networking. So what you're hoping is happening is that you'll be able to have a big premiere. You know, a local premiere, which is what we wanted to do with all the actors, all the cast, all the crew, all the investors, everybody involved in the film. And then hopefully you are following that with a stream of film festival appearances. And the whole idea of that is you go to them, you network, you meet other filmmakers, you hopefully meet people that help you with distribution, help get your next project off the ground, because you really do live and die by that at this stage as a filmmaker. You know, as you're trying to like build your, you know, your resume and things like that. So yeah, I mean, COVID-19 just completely put a stop to that. You know, obviously we were not able to have a premiere in theaters. Most festivals either canceled completely or went online or postponed. So slowly festivals started like reopening and figuring things out. And we, if the ones that are happening, most of them are online. There's a couple of festivals, like we got into a festival in Girona, Spain, and that's actually going to be live. That's the end of September. And then the El Paso Film Festival is going to be all online here. That's in October. And a festival in Austin, which is really cool, the Austin Revolution Film Festival, postponed it to March because they're hoping that there'll be a live element to it, that they'll be able to, you know, open up the theaters, everyone will be able to kind of network and kind of get to take advantage of what festivals are for. You know? So, and of course, that all depends on what happens with the pandemic, but, you know, we'll see.
Yeah, we'll see what happens. It seems to be the phrase of the era.
For sure. For sure. Play it by ear.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. I've been speaking with emerging filmmaker James Adebito, whose new film, I See a Darkness, shot entirely in El Paso and with Area Creatives, is readying for release on the film festival circuit. To learn more about the film, visit centennial-films.com. James, thank you so much for joining.
Thanks for having me, Kyle. Have a great day.
You too. On Film's producer and engineer is Seth Van Meter, and an archive of past programs can be found at ktep.org. I'm Kyle Alvarado, sitting in for Charles Horak, and thank you for joining me.